Accession number 17181, Reel 7.
Mr. Unwin, Reel 7.
Here on the coach we had at least two Cubans, and sometimes other local people came with the party, but one of them was he was certainly the number one birdman in Cuba, and was in fact head of the Natural History Department at Havana, in Havana, in the museum. And he was very, very good, spoke English. He'd even played tennis at Wimbledon, he and his brother, some years ago, but he's now up in his 60s, and that was many years ago. And the other Cuban was a much younger man, a married man. He was our fixer, also a knowledgeable birdman, so he was very useful all round. But they didn't exactly speak against Castro, but there was no, they never really praised him. And only on one occasion did one of our fellows, a chap from Yorkshire, baited them in a most obnoxious way, taunting them about Castro. But they weathered that. They didn't dispute it with him. They just let him fizzle out. None of the rest of the party sympathised with the fellow. That was the only time it might have got down to talking about Cuba today. Oh, but when I left the party to go around Havana, two ladies wanted to do the same thing. One of them, in fact, dropped out. But the other lady and I took a taxi from the Bay of Pigs up to Havana. And on the following day, we were walking around looking at museums and things. I wanted rather to look around nostalgic spots rather than museums. But nevertheless, she wanted to go into the Granmar exhibition, which was a ship Castro got to Cuba on. And we were walking around the town. We went in Hemingway's bars and that sort of thing. And then we saw an institute, and I said, oh, that thing might have been Finlay. The name just escaped me, but some English name, Finlay Institute. And we went, I said, let's go in here, because this is something to do with yellow fever. And we went up, and they were just closing. And the employees who were in the hallway, a few steps up, and then in the hallway, they said, lo siento, we're sorry, we're closing now. And at that moment, a quite distinguished-looking man came forward and spoke to us. He must have spoken in English, because I spoke Spanish, but not the lady. So he must have spoken in English. And we sat down, and we talked to him for a long time. And I said, Finlay. This is the Finlay Museum or something like that, whatever it was called. And he said, yes. I said, well, he's the man that eliminated yellow fever, isn't he? And I was wrong. It wasn't quite that. But nevertheless, we got in and we were talking. And this lady was very keen to hear his views on the subject, and she got completely the wrong end of the stick. This fellow was saying he was defending Castro, saying that he doesn't know why the Americans hold the embargo so tight for so long, and what it has to do with the Cuban people. Castro is more than ready all the time to go halves with them, put an end to the squabble. But I myself, my experience is that any time a move is made by the Americans, Castro just blasts it aside with anti-American slogans and whatnot. And I lay the blame for the non-finishing of the embargo on Castro's. This fellow in the institution, he was putting Castro's side forward all the time. And this lady was swallowing it hook, line, and sinker. And I didn't dispute with him at all. I just let him talk on. And I didn't even say to her, you know, what you've heard isn't quite, it's just rather one-sided. I just let it be. But there was an enormous amount of propaganda came out in that discussion, and he was the sort of man, really, who, the sort of fellow that had deserted Cuba, fled Cuba. He was of the same standing as all the people that got out in the early days, but he'd stayed on as director of this institution, and he didn't say a word against Castro. It can be that they consider it not worth the risk to say a word against Castro. And we could have gone into the next street and said to somebody, well, what we're hearing there is known. Then he'd have been in trouble. So you don't know how much of that is behind it. But from my point of view, he told the wrong side of the story.
So that was 93 you visited Cuba?
I think, in fact, it was maybe 92.
Now, another diplomatic posting that you had, I think in the 60s, was to Laos.
Yes, I went there in 64.
Can you tell me about that, please?
When I knew that was my posting, I didn't look forward to it. I didn't have any real desire to go there. I didn't know where it was. And when I first learned of the posting came to the embassy at Tel Aviv, and I'd seen the envelope, and it had my personal file on it, and it was my personal file number, and it was a very big, brown, big manila envelope. And it was time for me to go somewhere else, so I knew this must be my post report. You always get a post report to the place you're going, tell you all conditions of life there. And it was addressed to the head of Chancery, but his secretary hadn't collected it halfway through the day. So I went up to him and said, Arthur, there's a letter in your pigeonhole, and I know I'm sure it's my post report, it's got my personal file. He said, well, come and go and get it. So I brought it back to him, and he opened it and said, oh, it's addressed to you anyway inside, and gave it to me. And it was a long type page, the front page. It was quite a big thing because it had the post report. But there was a type page on top. And I couldn't stop to read it. All I wanted to see was the name of the post. And I said, Vientiane, where's Vientiane? And this head of Chancery said, it's in Phnom Penh, I think. So I said, it's not in Phnom Penh, because a particular girl I was working with had been posted to Phnom Penh. And I knew that was... No, he said it was in Cambodia, but I knew Cambodia was Phnom Penh. So he had an enormous wall map on his wall, going all around this wall looking for Vientiane, found it in Laos. And I was dismayed. I thought, how am I going to tell Marcia we're going to Vientiane? I thought, well, I won't. I'll not tell her about it for a day or so. I'll think about it. And we used to get the airmail papers in from London. Foreign Office sent out a bundle of airmail papers every day. And I got the Times and opened it a day or so after. And the headlines were Coup d'etat in Vientiane. And I thought, oh, heavens, that's now how can I tell her? Anyway, I told her, we went there, and it was an excellent post. It was the most enjoyable post.
This was 62, did you say?
64. December 64.
Why was it so good?
Well, life was very easy. The Lao were very pleasant people. They were very, very quiet, very almost indolent people. They never ran. They never shouted. They certainly never got ulcers. But the tempo of life was good, and it was an important post politically, because we were right on the edge of the Vietnam War, which was flaring up then, and there were troubles in Laos itself. Our military attaché had gone out to the Plain of Jaws, where the Pathet Lao were fighting the government troops. That's quite a long way from Vientiane. And he'd been taken prisoner. He'd been taken by the Pathet Lao. And a diplomat went out and negotiated his release. That quietened down. But the tempo of life was hectic. You lived on a nervous sort of level, but it was a very pleasant place to be. But factions of the royalist government, the government was divided into three parts. There was the royalist, the communists, and then there was a neutral section in the middle. This was in about 1952, when Laos was formed. And the communist part, the Pathet Lao, they chose to take no part in the government, so they deserted this tripartite government and set up themselves on the Plain of Jars. And the government in Vientiane consisted of the royalists and a neutral group. But the army factors were constantly fighting themselves, and a pitched battle took place in the immediate surround of the area, of the embassy, about a month or so after we got there. And the forces moving in onto Vientiane, we when we got into the embassy one particular morning, we could hear shell fire some way off. But through the morning, it got closer and closer, and we realised that trouble was fairly near. And the military attaché, he took up a post on the roof, weighing up what was going on. The rest of us were shepherded into a central corridor in the one-storey embassy building. It was just a spider building, and through the main length of the thing, there was a corridor. We were all sheltered into that. We had emergency rations for such a time, and shells fell all around the embassy. Across the road, the embassy building was just about 20 yards from the road, and there was a compound immediately the other side of the road, in which we later built a house for a security guard. But it, right in the middle of that, right in the middle of that small compound, one shell did land, and this was no more than 50 yards from the embassy, so it was fairly close at that time. There were others nearby, and my daughter, my wife had come into the embassy that day, and we'd left our daughter at our house about a mile away, a little house in a jungle area, and she was accompanied for this particular day by the daughter of the commercial attaché. And when the fighting, when the shelling got uncomfortably close, we thought it time to get home and find the youngsters. And a third chap wanted to get to his house, which was near ours, and his wife and child were there on their own. So we had a fairly alarming trip up to our house. We drove along a road raised above rice paddies on the right, and the shelling was coming from beyond the rice paddies over on the right. And immediately on the left of the road, near the embassy, was an army camp, which was the target of this shelling. And there were sentries out in the road. They held us up and wanted to know who we were, what we were doing, and eventually let us go. And when we got to the house, we went through into the hall, and the maid, our Lao maid, was on the floor saying prayers to Buddha. And we went into the bedroom, and our daughter and her friend had put all the mattresses on top of the bed and along the side of the bed, and they were both under the bed. And all the time, shells were screaming over the house. So it was a fairly awful time for them. But we got them out of the house and got them back to the embassy. So there were hectic moments like that. On another occasion, the police barracks were just some hundreds of yards away from the embassy. The police barracks were a great big area with huts spread all over the area. And the Air Force was a separate entity, the Lao Air Force, and they took it on themselves to bomb the police barracks. And we had, every month we used to have a church service. We had a church service every week, but it was done by a lay preacher, one of our little community. There were only about 25 people in the congregation, and we had a lay preacher, and they were read sermons. We got them from America, and just simply read the sermons out. But maybe every 3 months, the embassy chaplain down at Bangkok, had to leave Laos and get a re-entry visa. So he came up and took a service on the Sunday, and I got him on the Monday, I got him a re-entry permit from the Thai embassy in Vientiane, and he went back for another 3 months. He was from Northern Ireland, his setup to explain that. He was from Northern Ireland, but the British quota of immigrants into Thailand at that time was full, but not the Irish quota. And as a citizen born in any part of Ireland, he was entitled to an Irish passport. So he'd got an Irish passport and come out on the Irish quota. But this was on 3 months at a time and needed renewing. And on this particular day, I'd said, I'll take your passport up and get you a new visa. So I was in the Thai embassy and with two or three other people there after visas and whatnot. And I knew the embassy staff. And there was also a Canadian fellow who had become a Buddhist monk. And he was in there at the time in his saffron robe. And we were all chatting away while the visas were dealt with, when suddenly this bombing started. And we heard a bang, and I dashed out and saw bombs in the air coming down. And the police barracks was only a couple of hundred yards away by this time, but 500 or 600 from the embassy, but I'd moved towards it. And only a very short distance on the left was the American Community Association and the French Lycée, two fairly big compounds. And our daughter went to school at the French Lycée, and on this day she was in school. And the bombs were going all over the place, not just around the police camp. So that was an alarming thing. I got back to the embassy and gave this fellow his passport back, and he got into a vehicle and drove off to the crossing point for Thailand, which was about 20 kilometres down the river. And he said, "I'm going to dine out on this for months." And he left us. And that was another little episode when things got hairy in the compound.
Did you get to know any of the political leaders?
I was a consul, doing consul. So I got to know all the immigration leaders, the police chiefs. They were my counterparts in the Lao government. I didn't meet any of the... I went to functions when they were there, but you could hardly say I met them. I never met them socially at all, really, apart from national days and that sort of thing.
You said that some of them wore red and some of them wore blue neckerchiefs.
This was in the first fighting, when we a month after we got there. And we didn't know anything about the Lao army at all. We knew nothing about Laos. But we had seen military vehicles, little armoured cars, rather like Bren carriers of our wartime days. They had that sort of thing. And they used to... You'd see those about the town. But on this particular day, when this was brewing up, when this fighting was brewing up, they suddenly became much more apparent. They became much more in public view. And they were going up and down the embassy, and you saw that they all wore a red scarf. I forget with these people by the embassy, I forget whether they were red or blue. But the two factions in the dispute, never quite clear what the dispute was, but the two factions separated themselves with red and blue scarves. And these Bren carriers would pass with three or four fellows sitting up, and they'd all wear the same coloured scarf.
How much did communist ideology mean in a country like Laos?
It didn't really mean anything to them. Nothing at all, because the Pathet Lao had separated themselves from Vientiane, even from Luang Prabang, the royal capital. There was no sign of communism, and nobody was apparently communist. I never met anybody that said they were a communist. We made a lot of friends with Chinese. We made very good friends with Chinese people. They were all very, very much anti-communist. They were mostly hailed from Hong Kong with Hong Kong's people who'd come out of mainland China into Hong Kong and got a Hong Kong certificate of identity, a travel document, not a passport, and were travelling around with those. And they settled in Vientiane. All these people we met in Vientiane had settled there. And there was no sign of communism at all in Vientiane. Not between 1964 and 67.
What I was thinking...
There was, in fact, there was a large house which used to fly a communist flag, and this was the headquarters in Vientiane of the Lao Communist Party. So there was an official presence, but it didn't take any part in public life at all.
Was there much of an American military presence at this time?
Oh, there was a very big... There were thousands of Americans. There were very big aid programs. Everybody was doing aid programs. The Americans, they had villages. They built cluster villages outside Vientiane. And there were many thousands of them in these villages. About 6,000. I think there were about 6,000. We were about 200 Brits. And they were doing aid work. And this was, they were using land moving equipment and that sort of thing. And they used to do Air Continental and Air America. Continental Airlines and Air America were both there. And they were doing rice drops around the country, feeding the outlying settlements.
Were the Americans popular?
They were. Yes, there was no animosity against anybody in Laos. Nobody was hassled at all. The Japanese were there in large numbers. They were doing a water plant, water purification from the Mekong. We were doing a radio network. We were setting up the complete requirements of a radio network. We were building the studios, the booster stations around the country, the training of staff to run them. So.
And the communist powers, were they conducting efforts?
No, let's see.
The Russians or the Chinese?
The Russians were there, but I don't know, I can't remember any aid program they were undertaking. The Germans were largely in aid. I don't know, the French were the previously occupying power. They had presence there, they had an embassy, and they also had a military mission. They must have been training the Lao army. But I don't know of any I don't remember any aid program of the French. Their biggest presence was a military mission.
Which years were you in Laos?
From 64 to 67.
And in Cuba?
That was December 58. To July 61, and then from December 61 until I went to Cuba, I was in Tel Aviv